You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As the coronavirus crisis wears on, we are hearing from essential workers. And today we're going to the U.S. epicenter, New York City. Since the city reported its first case on March 1st, its health department has documented more than 186,000 cases, over 15,000 confirmed deaths. And then there are the evening cheers that erupt from windows in the city, paying respect to the doctors and nurses at shift change. What questions do you have for an ER physician who's battled through the worst of the pandemic in New York? We're at 800-642-1234. Dr. Kestrel Riopel is an emergency medicine physician in her residency at Maimonides Medical Center in Brooklyn. She hails from Oregon, Wisconsin, and is a graduate of the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Riopel, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Katie.
We're reaching you on your day off. You're making time for us on your day off. And I can only imagine that it must be so strange not being at your hospital today.
It's strange, but it's welcome. It's nice to have a little time to relax here.
How often do you get some time off?
Lately, more time off. In March and April, very little time off. So there's, you know, it ebbs and flows the amount of volume that we're seeing, and our schedule is always in flux. And there's a long list of backup physicians, and we kind of have to be ready to, you know, dedicate the next week to the hospital at any time. And then when things slow down, we, you know, get some last minute happy news that maybe we'll have most of the week off. And that's where I am this week. So
you've been working at your hospital, Maimonides, for 2 years in the ER. When did you first realize that this pandemic would overwhelm the health system in New York?
I think it was in, you know, late February, early March. I think it's the same time the rest of the country started thinking about it and talking about it. But I don't think at that point we knew that we would be, you know, the first hit and the hardest hit. I remember, you know, reading the news about the cases kind of cropping up in the suburbs of Seattle, out in Washington, and then a few cases in California, and not thinking that our city would be really any different than the rest of the country. But, you know, in mid-March, it started making itself more apparent. And then we really had to start revving up our efforts.
I just was looking at a picture of you intubating a patient. What is that like, you know, putting these patients on ventilators and the precautions that you have to take?
Good question. So if I can take a moment, I'd actually like to talk about that particular patient. That was in early March when, you know, we'd seen a couple of COVID patients at our hospital, but not a ton. We weren't yet in the swing of wearing a ton of PPE. We weren't wearing hoods to intubate. I don't know if many people know this, but intubating is kind of one of the most dangerous procedures you can do in terms of exposing yourself to the virus and inoculating, because of your kind of basically the whole point of intubation is to create a direct line of sight between your eyes and your face and the patient's trachea so that you know you're putting the tube in the right spot. And so it's very dangerous for that reason. And that patient I was intubating was, you know, a patient who came in with trouble breathing and looked to us like she probably had a really, really bad heart attack, and her heart just wasn't pumping. And that backloads a lot of fluid onto the lungs and makes it hard to breathe. But unfortunately, when we, you know, consulted the cardiology service and some other people in the hospital to try to get her the right care, coronavirus was very much on the brain, and there was a lot of fear that this patient may be COVID, and that's why she couldn't breathe. And so you know, the amount of PPE I'm wearing in that picture to intubate is not what you would see people using now in the COVID era, and it's kind of scary. But
yeah, I could see your hair, for instance. It was, you know, and now we don't see barely a piece of skin from people working with patients.
Exactly. So I think we probably would have gone about that differently had it been even a week later, you know. But that's just an example of how things in the ER have changed on a day-to-day basis. One day I'm wearing my old outfit and, you know, the next day it's a whole nother set of protection.
From what you're seeing, are ventilators an effective way to treat this illness?
They are when utilized for the right population of patients. So I know there's a lot of discussion about who to ventilate and when to ventilate and if ventilation is effective. And I think the main reason this is, you know, so contentious right now is because right off the bat, when the outbreak started, there were a lot of physicians and practitioners theorizing that aggressive early ventilation of everyone requiring more than a few liters of oxygen is the way to go. And then we saw, you know, really bad outcomes. And that's not to say, because we have no evidence that ventilation of COVID causes death or morbidity, but there's definitely a correlation, if not a causation. And so that's when we started thinking about this more. And there are certainly a lot of people out there with COVID illness that do need to be ventilated. And that's the only way to effectively and aggressively oxygenate their lungs, or what, you know, little functioning lung they have working at the peak of illness. But certainly there are other people that you can hold off. And it appears by using non-invasive measures, we have been able to avoid some intubations or some ventilators at our shop, which is really exciting news.
We're talking with Dr. Kestrel Riopelle, who grew up in Oregon, Wisconsin. She's now doing her residency at Maimonides Medical Center in Brooklyn. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Dr. Riopelle, the familiar symptoms of the coronavirus are the high fever, the flu-like symptoms, the loss of smell and taste. From your perspective as a physician, what is different about this virus from other illnesses?
First off, you know, we kind of have like a running joke at work that, you know, you can come in with literally any chief complaint and it ends up being coronavirus. I mean, you named the most common symptoms, but we have seen it all, honestly. You know, someone will come in with back pain and it'll be coronavirus, or kidney stone, it'll be coronavirus. I mean, it's just crazy. And I think what's going on there is just a whole systemic inflammatory response. And, you know, later on in the illness, your body's own immune response causing inflammation everywhere that could really, really lead to any sort of symptom or any organ system dysfunction. And that's not normally what you see with like the flu per se.
So it could do, you know, something different in every single patient, every single person, you might see something different.
Exactly. There are certainly common threads, you know, lung involvement is common. We're now seeing blood clotting is very common. So a lot of people coming in with clots in the legs or the lungs. But other than, you know, those few common threads, yeah, it's pretty much a wild card, which is frustrating.
We're talking with emergency medicine physician Kestrel Riopelle, talking about her work on the front lines of COVID-19 at her hospital in Brooklyn. Do you want to know what treatments have worked best for physicians fighting the coronavirus in New York City? Are you concerned that Wisconsin could see a similar surge? Be part of this with your questions, your situation at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back in a minute with Dr. Riopelle right here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with a Wisconsin native, a physician working on the front lines caring for COVID patients in New York. Throughout the pandemic, New Yorkers, they've saluted healthcare professionals every evening at 7 with claps and shouts and lots of banging on whatever is handy. COVID-19 has ravaged New York. The cases in this state are twice as many as any other state in the country has reported. Are you a physician or clinician? Are you treating patients with COVID-19? What do you want to know from New York? Join in at 800-642-1234. We have emergency medicine physician Castrell Riopel, who is in her residency at a hospital in Brooklyn, and she stays with us. Dr. Riopel, you know, there have been so many aha moments here, and as bystanders of us who are not in healthcare, we're watching some pretty creative discoveries. Are there any tips or things that have occurred in your ER that were a discovery in a surge when you were experiencing a surge? Have there been aha moments?
Good question, Kate. The main one I can think of off the top of my head is when we kind of started experimentally proning all of our awake patients. And what proning means is having a patient lay on their belly instead of on their back. And that helps the back of the lungs that are normally, you know, full of virus and disease because they're gravity dependent. It helps them get oxygen better. And this is normally something before the COVID pandemic that would only be employed on the absolute sickest patients in the ICU on a ventilator. And we were having these patients with low oxygen levels in our ER that we were worried we were going to have to ventilate. And by a simple request of asking them to lay on their stomach, their oxygen would come up miraculously. And it's been it's not a cure, but it's been a really good temporizing measure to bridge some of these patients to further care without being put on a ventilator. And now, I mean, we started doing that, a couple months ago, and now it's just common. It's practice, standard practice for everyone that comes in.
Yeah. How many of your coworkers are contracting the coronavirus themselves, and what are you seeing out there?
Good question. So we're getting antibody testing at our hospital right now. So we all kind of sign up for our appointment and go get our blood drawn. And I think the latest numbers are we're somewhere around at least the frontline workers. I can only speak for, you know, my emergency department. We're somewhere around 15%. So, you know, people are getting sick. That's in contrast now to the data that was published a couple days ago for all of New York City, just, you know, the general population was coming in at 20% positive. So even though we are at much higher risk, this does go to show that PPE really, really does work. You know, if it weren't for PPE, I'm sure we'd be coming in at rates twice or three times the general population. So that it is reassuring in that sense.
Have you had enough personal protective equipment, all of the gowns and the masks that you need?
I have been fortunate enough at my hospital to have everything I need. We've been really good about acquiring, you know, more than you'd theoretically need, just to be safe. I know there are other hospitals in New York City that have struggled with that. And yeah, my heart goes out to them. And obviously, between hospitals, we're sharing as well as we can to try to, you know, after the initial scramble for PPE, to try to kind of even out the distribution.
I'm curious why you're getting antibody tests versus getting the test for the actual virus.
Right. Good question. So right now, there is not much one would be able to do with the result of their antibody test. And that is to say that we don't know how good the antibodies are against the virus yet. We don't know how long they protect against the virus, if it's for a couple months, a couple years. Usually for these kinds of seasonal viruses, it's a few years, or if it's for a lifetime, you know. And so if someone was positive or negative, it wouldn't really, it shouldn't change the way they act and protect themselves. The reason we're doing it right now is for the purpose of research and for you know, demographic studies and public health just to use for a variety of projects. And that's really why the employees are volunteering. Of course, some of us are just curious. But if you really did want to know if you're acutely infected, you should get the standard PCR test.
Yeah, it's interesting that your own employees are also involved in the study of something that you're so wanting to cure and to contain. How is morale right now among the staff?
It's good, actually. You know, there tend to be hard days because, you know, even though the majority of people with COVID are going to do well and going to survive, we see the sickest ones, and we spend the most time each shift with the sickest ones, and we'd spend our time making family calls to the ones who are doing poorly, and that can really bring things down. But I don't know, there's something about all going through the same thing at the same time that's really created a lot of bonding within the hospital. And I feel much closer now to my nurses and ancillary staff than I ever have before. And so many gracious businesses out here donating meals to us every day, and we're able to kind of share those together. And it's turned out well, actually. The morale is good.
We're talking with Wisconsin native Dr. Kestrel Riopel, who is in her emergency medical residency at Maimonides Medical Center in Brooklyn. Are you a physician or a nurse? What questions do you have for an ER doctor who has battled the worst of the pandemic? Still time to talk at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Riopel, what is death like for families because they can't be there?
Yeah, that's definitely the hardest part. I wish I could say what it's like for them, but I'm on one side of the phone and they're on the other, and it's devastating. Truly, the grace of some of the families I've talked about who are thanking us for our work in, you know, the midst of me telling them their loved one has passed away is just, it's truly, truly humbling. But yeah, it's really, really tough. I'm sure you can imagine in a normal situation, a family member who's present can see everything we're doing for their loved one, right? They know how bad it is, and they can see where there are tons of people in the room, and we're giving CPR and we're doing everything we can. And now in this situation, you know, they have to trust us, and we have to do our best to convey that every measure was taken, and they're truly grateful, which I appreciate.
I've been hearing about that it's your generation of physicians who are doing a lot of this caring for COVID-19 patients, physicians recently out of medical school. What do you think this will do to your career, your path as a physician?
I think that the training and the experience I'm getting here right now is something that is irreplaceable, and I would never get in another decade or in another location. And I'm really, really grateful for the experience. I feel that I can relate to these patients and families on another level than I was able to before. And I'm really grateful for that experience. But yeah, certainly it's not something I'm going to forget anytime soon. And I hope it only, you know, it only seems to so far be contributing to my education. So if there is a sliver of light, it's that, you know, I've learned a lot, and especially about humanity and interacting with people from this experience, not just about the medicine.
Is there any sense that the worst of this pandemic is behind you? What are you thinking about?
Oh, interesting question. I feel like we all kind of think it's too soon, and we don't want to get our hopes up. And definitely, you know, the hospital is still planning for multiple other waves, and we're still ordering extra supplies and, you know, planning as if it's not over. But there definitely is like a little sigh of relief in the air right now that's palpable. And And hopefully it sticks around.
Ruth from West Allis called, and she's a retired nurse, would like to know if you have others in your home, and if so, what kind of clothing change do you do, and what is your routine when you get home?
Oh, thanks, Ruth. That's a good question. So for me, I just live alone in an apartment, so I can't speak to that, but definitely have talked about it with many of my coworkers. And it seems like the consensus on what people try to do is, you know, wear a different outfit or set of scrubs during the commute. And then, you know, the outfit or the scrubs you wear at the hospital to take those off before you go home and, you know, throw them straight in the wash. But unfortunately, I can't really speak to that myself.
Dr. Riopel, thank you so much for your service and for joining us and taking the time.
Yeah, of course. Thanks, Kate.
Dr. Kestrel Riopel is an emergency medical doctor at Maimonides in Brooklyn, where she's been spending most of her time treating patients with the coronavirus, a native of Oregon, Wisconsin. Coming up, we get another perspective from New York as we talk with a Wisconsin nurse who spent 20 days in the ICU at Woodhull Medical Center in Brooklyn, where she too contracted the coronavirus. We talked to her from her home in Hayward, where she's recovering. That's right after this news update here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We are hearing the stories of healthcare workers who responded to the coronavirus epicenter. As New York's situation grew dire through March and April, thousands of medical professionals from across the country raced to assist, answering the call to volunteer on the front lines in New York City. Maybe you or a loved one has volunteered in a healthcare capacity. What is it like to respond to an urgent need, a disaster? Join in at 800-642-1234. Elizabeth Riley is a registered nurse at Cumberland Healthcare in Barron County. She worked for 20 days in the ICU at Woodhull Medical Center in Brooklyn. That's one of the boroughs of New York. She is in quarantine right now at home in Hayward, recovering from COVID-19. Elizabeth, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you for having me, Kate.
How are you doing today? Because I imagine it's one day at a time.
Well, it's fine. I mean, people say, how are you? I say, fine, just like most people. But it's the problems that I continue to have with COVID is because I don't know if you mentioned this, I did get it.
Yeah.
From being in there. So right now, the problems that I have are I get very short of breath easily. I can't smell anything and I can't taste anything. But other than that, it's, you know, it's fine. I can get up and move around and things like that. It just makes you feel really tired, I guess, toward the end here. I'm hoping that this is going to resolve soon. I had a test yesterday, so I'm really hoping that I'll find out today it's negative.
Oh, I hope so, too. You've been testing regularly, I understand.
Yeah, I tested when I got back from New York, and then because I was unable to get a test while I was in New York. And then I tested, that came back positive. So I waited 2 weeks, and then I had another test, and that came back positive. And then I waited another week and had a test yesterday. So I'm very hopeful that this one will come back negative. And I can at least be closer to my husband than 10 feet apart when we are in shared space here in the house. Usually I just stay up in my room so that there's no possibility of me infecting him. But otherwise, I wear a mask and we stay 10 feet apart. And I can't really touch anything that he's going to touch in the other part of the house.
Elizabeth, let's go back to the beginning of April. You're traveling to New York to work and help patients with COVID-19. What caused you to make that decision?
Well, there are a couple of things that happened at the right time. First of all, I would, with everybody else, watch Governor Cuomo pleading for help. that they didn't have enough equipment, they didn't have enough people. I saw photographs of healthcare staff just being wiped out by this. And where I work, as what happened with most small hospitals and people not knowing what to expect, we did what everybody did, which was to postpone a lot of our procedures, day surgeries, things like that, and our inpatient census dropped as we waited to see kind of what was going to happen. So we had a low census. I found out that there was this organization, and it's nice to consider that I volunteered to go there. I volunteered to go there, but I got paid. So I don't want you to think I just dropped everything and went out there without being paid. But I found out about that, and I thought, well, if they're going to be cutting hours back at the hospital, which they wound up doing in most hospitals, and Cumberland was very creative in trying to keep people with as many hours as they needed. But I thought, well, if I can go there, then my colleague won't have to give up hours on her part. And so it worked out. My director of nursing and the other people there gave me permission to go. And so I went. It just worked out. But I also have to say, I love New York City. I've been there a number of times because I have a cousin who used to live there. And it is there's everything you could imagine in that city. People from all over the world live there, and just walking around, listening to people talk is like listening to music. Mm. It's a wonderful, wonderful city. And when Governor Cuomo said, if you help us, we'll help you. And I knew that that was true. So I went.
Elizabeth Riley is a nurse at Cumberland Healthcare, and she treated patients with COVID-19 in a hospital in Brooklyn for 20 days. And you can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Elizabeth, what was it like for you in the hospital that you were assigned to? What were you doing, and what was it like?
Well, I had ICU experience years and years ago. So when I called to see if they would take me, that was really what they were looking for, was emergency department and ICU. And so I explained that it was years and years ago that I'd had ICU experience, but I felt like I could learn it again. And they said, great, when can you get here? Can you get here tomorrow? That was how fast this whole thing happened. So when I got there, I was assigned, it was very militarily run. There were 500 of us who got there and descended on these hotels throughout the city. And so we had to show up in this one room and sign in, and there were people, listen up, you know, I mean, it was get in line. I like these chairs in line. And so it was very, I thought, militarily run. But it only took them a day before they figured out where we were going to go and how the buses were going to get us there. And there were some glitches with that kind of thing early on, but things got smoothed out. So I was assigned to Woodhull Medical Center in Brooklyn and in an ICU there. That hospital is really big, and they have a lot of ICUs. And the first one I was in,
ICUs, plural, so more than one ICU in the hospital.
That is correct.
Wow.
Yes, more than one. And more than one emergency department, too. They had an extended stay emergency department, a get them in, get them out emergency department, you name it, they had it. So I was initially in one of those ICUs that was built to be an ICU. It had glass doors. The patient beds were close enough to the doors that you could move the IV pumps out of the room so that if there was a machine that was and was the alarm was going off on a pump, or you noticed that you needed more medication before the bag ran out, you could go get those things without having to go into the patient room. So, and then you could see the patient because the doors were glass. What they finally wound up doing, because of the capacity of patients who needed ventilation, they took a medical surgical unit and they made the middle portion of that into sort of a makeshift ICU so they could put more people down there. And that's where I wound up. I spent the first three or four days bumping back and forth between real ICU to real ICU. And then they opened up this other one and put me there permanently. So it was, in theory, a good idea. But in practice, it was very difficult to manage because it wasn't set up to be an ICU. Yeah. And so the doors are all wooden doors and you can't see through them. But if you open them up, then you run the risk of
infection,
coronavirus,
yeah,
getting out into the hospital. And it was just really difficult. They had to modify the sinks in the room. And the hospital looks kind of new from the outside, but it's really kind of old on the inside.
They
have these little round... Go ahead.
How many patients were you taking care of at once?
I had up to three patients. That last place I was at, that makeshift ICU, there were a lot of double rooms. So I had two patients in one room, and then about four doors down, I had another patient.
How did you gown up? How did you get your personal protective equipment on? How did you learn how to put it on?
Well, actually, I learned how to put it on when working at Cumberland, because whenever there's something like this that comes down, it happened with Ebola when that was there too, everybody gets a brand new tutorial on how to gown up and how to remove your protective equipment safely. And then you have to test out on it. So we all get taught how to do that. And Cumberland just stays up there with all the rest of the people and keeping its employees up to date and being safe. Well, at Woodhull, it's the same thing. You know how to put it on, you know how to take it off. So my routine was, when I got there, was to try to find covers for my shoes. And there were a couple times when those were not available. So I had to take, you know, those blue filmy gauzy hats.
Sure, yeah.
Like shower caps.
Yeah.
I had to put two of those over each foot. And they're really slippery. They're hard to walk around in. But I needed to have my feet covered because I'm walking through COVID all day. So those were the first things that went on. And then I would put one of those little shower caps on my hair. And then I would wear my N95 mask. We were issued one N95 mask every 5 days. And the elastic on mine broke one time, and I had to sign about three pieces of paper just to get a new one. And over the N95, we would put a paper surgical mask because we had to wear the N95s for 5 days, and they were going to get COVID on them. So we'd cover them with a paper mask and then put on a face shield. So the foot covers, the hair cover, the two masks, and the face shield were automatic every morning. And then when you go into a patient room, you would have to put on a blue plastic gown and gloves. And because I had a double room, and then you also have to make sure that you have everything you need so that you're not going in the room that often, because the more you're in that room, the more you expose yourself, and you have to open the door, and, you know, all kinds of things that really you want to minimize.
Oh, so organized, painstaking. Elizabeth Riley, nurse in Barron County. She returned last month from New York after treating patients with the coronavirus. She's currently recovering from COVID-19. What do you want to know about nursing care and COVID? Do you have questions about treatment, managing symptoms? Be part of this 800-642-1234. Back in a moment with Elizabeth Riley here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thousands of medical professionals have answered the call to work on the front lines in New York City. We're hearing from a nurse in Hayward who did just that. Are you or a loved one recovering from the coronavirus? What are your days like? Have you volunteered in a disaster before, or maybe in the current crisis? What is it like to respond when you know your skills are essential? Still time for you, 800-642-1234. Elizabeth Riley is a nurse in Barron County. She treated COVID patients in New York for 20 days, where she also contracted the disease. Let's take a call now. Judy is here from Ripon. Hi, Judy.
Hi. I'm also an ICU nurse, but I've not worked for the last year, so I could have been really helpful, but I didn't know where to go. I want to know the logistics of how she found out what website she went to, how she signed up, and how they dealt with licensing, because I'm only licensed in Wisconsin, and, you know, just all those. So how did she find out about how to go, how to actually do it? Help us off here.
Yeah, Judy, thanks.
Yeah, I'm happy to address that. Actually, I found out, of all things, on Facebook. There was a Facebook page for an organization called Crucial Staffing. That's Crucial with a K. And they are an emergency management group out of Kansas. So they were advertising on Facebook, and I just happened to see it. Some people from work just happened to see it, and we were talking, wow, that sounds like it might be an interesting thing. And that's when our hours were low. So I thought, well, I talked to my boss and said, if I can get through and get in, could I have that time off? And he said, yes. So then what you have to do is wait for them to tell you on Facebook that they have an opening, and they're going to start taking phone call applications. And then you wind up dialing, because it's busy. And I finally got in and talked to somebody, and they said, when can you start? Didn't matter if I was from Wisconsin, and didn't matter where my license was, as long as my license was in good standing and that I had an immunization record I could show them. So basically, do you have a pulse? Yes. When can you get here?
Judy, thank you for the call. Let's go to Kathy now in Fontana. Hi, Kathy.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
My question is, I have family and friends that I love dearly, but they think this is all a hoax, and it's just a matter of the flu and the media is blowing it out of proportion. I'm scared to death. I'm following all the rules, and now Wisconsin has decided to open things up. So I have friends and family that are, hey, let's go down to the bar. Let's go shopping. Let's go to this restaurant. Let's go there. I'm hibernating. I'm not doing that. I'm going to work, but that's it. And I just think, I don't want to get into arguments with these people. I just tell them, I guess we can't talk about this anymore. And I'm just wondering, is there something that could be said to make them realize how real this is?
Kathy, thanks. Elizabeth, social distancing and being careful, what can you say?
You know, I just wish that it would be possible for me to walk everybody who thinks this is just the flu through my ICU and let them spend 10 minutes looking at all those people on ventilators. This is not just the flu. It's a terrible disease. It's very difficult to deal with, and it's easy to get. I had all the protective equipment I needed, and I still got it. Now, as far as people opening, there are CDC guidelines that are out now on the CDC webpage that give step-by-step detailed instructions, including algorithms on what you need to look for before you should open and how you should open slowly. One of our problems is that we have an administration that buried that report, and they wouldn't let those guidelines be published until the media called them out on it. And finally, as of yesterday, those guidelines have been published. So I would urge any business that wants to reopen to look at those guidelines and find out what they need to do. In my mind, I think it was terrible that they overturned the stay-at-home orders. Wisconsin's cases continue to rise. And why we are now saying, when the cases are going up, okay, everybody get together in close quarters again, it's just beyond all reason to me. But my experience is, and I'm sad to say this, people who believe it's a hoax are told it's a hoax, and they are going to continue to believe it, no matter how much evidence you put in front of them.
Elizabeth, you worked primarily with people on ventilators who were diagnosed with COVID. What was it like treating people being on ventilators?
It was like going to a different world every day. Because these people are, they're on ventilators, they're sedated. You know, the goal is to get them off sedation and try to wean them off that ventilator. But in my time there, nobody that I worked with got off a ventilator. I'm sure they were getting off them somewhere, because they would pipe these really terrific New York songs through the intercom when somebody was extubated, because it was a really big deal when somebody got off a vent. But it never happened with one of my patients. So it felt like everywhere you went, somebody was on a vent and they were probably going to die. Because what you wind up doing is managing the sedation, the medications, the blood pressure medications that are going in. And sometimes that's what's keeping these people alive. They are one vent setting or one drip calculation off from dying. And they can't talk because they're ventilated and sedated. So I would go in and talk to them and say, I'm going to suction your mouth now, and I'm going to clean it out for you and make you more comfortable. And I'm going to turn you now, or I'm going to provide skin care. You talk to them and hope they can hear you and understand so they're not frightened. But I think that's the worst thing about this, is that so many people who were so sick were so frightened.
Elizabeth Riley with us. She's a nurse at Cumberland Healthcare in Barron County. She spent 20 days in an ICU in New York. Elizabeth, Barb from Rice Lake called in, couldn't stay with us. Barb says, you are a hero in her mind, no matter if you got paid for the work or not. And she feels really proud to be from the same county.
I think that that is the nicest thing in the world. And I know when I was out there, I did a lot of writing about it. I called it my on-the-bus writings, because every morning I had between 30 and 40 minutes on the bus. And what I would do is use that time to sort of arrange my thoughts about what had happened the day before and how I was going to try to frame my day coming up. It's the hardest work you will. My hat is off to ICU nurses who were there before I got there and who will be there long after I left. Those people do a yeoman's job. They are incredible. There was one day on Easter Sunday, we had, I don't know if you know what a code is. You hear it on TV, code blue. And there's a flat line on the EKG and they shock them and then their heart rate comes back and everybody's fine and goes home happy. We had 7 codes on Easter Sunday. And of those codes, we had 3 deaths. And we would barely get a code cart put together again, and then somebody else would code. And it felt like there was nothing but death everywhere. And, I mean, I'm not the most positive person in the world to begin with, more of a glasses half empty kind of gal. But there's no humor in any of this. There's no joke or fun or way to make light any of this. People were dying every day in there. And the day I got there, April 3rd, in this country, we had 7,000 deaths. Today, 6 weeks later, 84,000 dead in this country.
What could Wisconsin learn from New York and how New York is handling this?
Well, I think we need to... Well, number one, opening things up, I think, is a mistake. And I understand, believe it or not, I have great empathy for small business owners. But I think people have to start looking at who they should really be angry at here. It's not the people who are trying to lock themselves down and keep them and their themselves and their families safe. What they need to do is look and see, where did all that small business money go to?
Well,
many rich people are getting stuff and at the expense of small business.
Elizabeth, we're out of time. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
And take care. Elizabeth Riley, a nurse and care management coordinator at Cumberland Healthcare. She treated patients for 20 days in Brooklyn. Just ahead, we transition to art and comics. Get inspired about doodling. I'm Kate Archer Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.